Hello, everybody. You are listening to Trent Radio, CFFF FM, 92.7 from Peterborough, Ontario. And I'm just wanted to tell everyone have a really nice day. Have a really good day, everyone.
Trent Radio, 92.7 FM, CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajawinang, Peterborough, Ontario. Every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, Ellie Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. In the background, we're listening to the work of Christine Bougie from the original soundtrack of the film The Rainbow Kid. What is stranger than nonfiction? Often labeled as subjective or objective, there is nonetheless a long tradition of reenactments in documentary films. Could there ever be objective truth in documentaries? The use of reenactments, says one article, has filmmakers, film theorists, and critics divided. Some believe the use of reenactments brings historical accuracy into question, while others feel it enhances history. More recently, exploitive crime television shows and docudramas that utilize reenactments are often over-the-top melodrama, thus further fueling this topic and giving it a poor name. I wouldn't characterize documentary filmmaking as anything other than fiction, says filmmaker academic Trevor Hearing. Regarding documentary method as a form of fiction is a more sophisticated way of thinking about the constructed character of the communication. Hearing says this is because you are making creative decisions in the selection of what you are filming, in any subsequent manipulation of the narrative, in the way in which it's constructed in the edit as well. Hearing thinks it's a false dichotomy to say that one is working purely in terms of one direction, translating factual data into a fictional output, or the other, working with data to create a factual output. Hearing does not regard documentary and fiction in narrow terms. He says they are all constructs. As writer John Harrington says, film rhetoric is as necessary to disseminate truth as it is to create falsehoods. Raw images simply do not necessarily convey reality to an audience. Art moves beyond simply recording reality and instead transforms chance reality into coherence. It's the director's job to maintain the cinematic coherence. On reenactments in documentaries, I believe cinema is just another language, another way to tell a story. So when an audience is engaged, as writer Robert McKee says, no matter how intimate or epic the setting, Instinctively, the audience draws a circle around the characters on screen and their world. In other words, the story takes precedence, one scene after another. So the elements go by fast. There's no time to think about it. And they culminate. The story has hooked us. How does it do that? My attempt to reduce what McKee says about story is this. The audience follows a likable protagonist while the potential to attain what she wants through her will and actions motivated by conscious and unconscious desires. A recent documentary, The Rescue, from 2021, directed by Elizabeth Chai, Vassar Helyi, and Jimmy Chin, used reenactments to excellent storytelling effect. Challenged by no footage of the 2018 rescue attempt to save 12 young members of a Thai soccer club and their coach from an underwater cave, the filmmakers built one and restaged the rescue. In piecing together without access to footage, dramatic reenactments with the original divers would play a crucial role in their project. Some of the most suspenseful moments are depicted in dramatic reenactments. In my film review, I said, expertly told with nail-biting suspense, this documentary has children in peril, real-life human heroics, and a touch of superstition, all elements for making a great story. I strapped myself in and enjoyed this inspiring wild ride. I did not mention anything about the reenactments. Like most filmgoers, I set my attention on the characters and the story. Part of its success was the participation of real-life divers from the mission. They didn't want to just supervise the reenactments, they also were willing to star in them. It had to be them, director Chin told Insider. The divers brought their suits to a submerged tank in Pinewood Studios in the UK and reenacted their rescue for the IMAX underwater cinematography of Ian Seabrook. Vassar Helyi and Chin were at one point concerned what they were filming was going the way of bad unsolved mysteries reenactment footage. We were worried we were going too far with the dramatics, said Chin. It succeeds, in fact, because there is no cue to signal the reenactment for the audience. Jacob Bricka notes this new trend in his 2023 book, How Documentaries Work. It's a trend that is the increasingly subtle and sometimes non-existent cues employed to mark the use of reenactments in documentary. As an example, Bricka breaks down the opening scene from the Netflix documentary Bikram Yogi Guru Predator, directed by Eva Orner, 2019, about yoga teacher Bikram Chaudhary. As the audience hears an audio recording of Bikram beginning one of his classes, they see a hand enter the frame to turn an indoor thermostat all the way up. Sweaty bodies perform their poses in extremely shallow focus shots that perfectly frame the participants with smooth, professional camera moves. And finally, an archival still image arrives on the screen of Chaudhary leading a class from back in the day, surrounded by a sea of followers. And up to this point in the scene, everything had been a reenactment. Though there is no obvious visual treatments to mark them as such. The coding is so subtle that it is simply left up to the deductive reasoning of the audience to discern what must be going on. It is the very professionalism of the camera work and its au courant shallow focus style that provides the tip-off. One might admire Robert Flaherty's Nanook of the North for the evidence it provides, says Bill Nichols in Documentary Reenactment and the Fantastasmic Subject. But his entire salvage anthropology model of coaxing the subject, a la Karaliak, to do what Nanook would have done some 30 years earlier, without motorized vehicles, rifles, canned food, wood frame homes, or filmmaker along for the ride, amounted to one colossal, unacknowledged reenactment, and therefore, fraud. John Harrington, in The Rhetoric of Film, says the emergence of the documentary gave more meaning to recorded images of reality. John Grierson, who coined the term documentary, defined the purpose of the genre as the creative treatment of actuality. Reenactments, the more or less authentic recreation of prior events, provided a staple element of documentary representation until they were slain by the Verite boys of the 1960s. Among these boys, filmmakers like Robert Drew, Ricky Leacock, D.A. Pennebaker, David and Albert Maysles, and Fred Wiseman, according to film scholar Bill Nichols, proclaimed everything except what took place in front of the camera without rehearsal or prompting to be a fabrication. According to writer Catherine Lupton, Chris Marker had coined cinema verite, a play of course on the term cinema verite by separating ma from cinema to change the common phrase's meaning from cinema truth to cine my truth, signaling that he had no intention of abandoning personal expression as a means of cinematically engaging with the world. The filmmaker subordinates light and sound to her storytelling purposes to create a new hyper-reality that demands the viewer's attention. For the director, the story takes precedence in what Werner Herzog has called the documentary's ecstatic truth, the truth beyond the cinematic actuality, that there is a deeper stratum of truth in cinema, Herzog says. It is mysterious and elusive and can be reached only through fabrication, imagination, and stylization. Outlined in his famous Minnesota Declaration, Herzog's first item says, "The so-called cinema verite is devoid of verite. It reaches a merely superficial truth, the truth of accountants." You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio, 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso, in this audio program, Film Theory Meets Film Music. I checked out the documentary Keyboard Fantasies recently, the Beverly Glenn Copeland story, a documentary directed by Posey Dixon, and was released in 2019. And it didn't use reenactments very much in the style of the making of it. Instead of using reenactments, it would illustrate stories through stock footage, found footage alone. The film's description, a sci-fi-obsessed woman living in near isolation, Beverly Glenn Copeland wrote and self-released Keyboard Fantasies in Huntsville, Ontario back in 1986. Recorded in an Atari-powered home studio, the cassette featured seven tracks of a curious folk electronica hybrid, a sound realized far before its time. And three decades on, the musician, now Glenn Copeland, began to receive emails from people across the world, thanking him for the music they'd recently discovered. Released in 1986, but rediscovered in 2005 to great acclaim, Keyboard Fantasies, the album by Black transgender Canadian singer-songwriter, went on to be named as the public vote winner of the Polaris Heritage Prize at the 2020 Polaris Music Prize. Keyboard Fantasies was remastered and reissued in February of 2017. Before Glenn Copeland's gender transition was made public, Keyboard Fantasies was selected as one of the 70 greatest recordings by women by The Stranger. From Wikipedia, Keyboard Fantasies is an album by Canadian musician Beverly Glenn Copeland, self-released on Atlas Records as a cassette in 86. A time when Glenn Copeland was best known for his music for children's television, notably Mr. Dress-Up. The album was inspired by the nature and environment of his home in Huntsville, Ontario, including the surrounding lakes and woods. Recorded using only a Yamaha DX7 and a Roland TR-707 drum machine, the musician felt he could musically display the feelings that the environment gave him accurately. He felt the entirely electronic instrumentation he used was comparable to an orchestra because of the range of sounds he could create. We're listening to a track from Keyboard Fantasies called Old Melody by Beverly Glenn Copeland.
By 1983, there was another computer called an Atari, and I bought one, and I had a TR-707 drum machine. I think I had bought a DX7 just before that. I suddenly, for the first time in my life, I had access to wild sounds that a piano couldn't make, that a traditional acoustic instrument couldn't make. Plus, I had access to things that almost sounded like a violin. If you squinted really hard with your ears, it was like finding toys that you'd always hoped you might find, but didn't really know what they'd look like until one day you found them.
So when this record came about, it was just 200 copies, Let It Go,
Yeah, well, you know, you press 200 copies and you think, if I even pressed that many. Yeah. And I thought, okay, well, it'd be wonderful if I sold them. I sold 50, right? If that many, and that was it.
Yeah.
And so next, but I wasn't counting it, I was just.
And you weren't in a sort of new age scene back then?
There was no new age scene.
You're just there, alone.
Well, there was a little bit of one.
Yeah.
There was a tiny bit.
Were you still
one.
In Canada at this point?
Yeah.
Oh, whereabouts? Yeah.
I lived in what's called the Muskokas,
okay.
Which is it's Ontario, about 2.5 hours north of Toronto. It's gorgeous, utterly gorgeous.
Let it go, let it go now. It's okay.
In the December or November of 2015, I suddenly got an email through my website. A gentleman in Japan. He wrote me and said, do you have any copies of your cassette called Keyboard Fantasies? I sent him 30 copies. A week later, he got back to me and said, I've sold those all in 3 days. Would you send me more? And then I sent him the last of what I had, and he sold them. When I looked him up, I just found a little record shop, but I had no idea what his online presence was. Inside of 2 months, I had 10 offers from different record companies to re-release that album and everything else I'd ever put out.
We're listening to clips from Keyboard Fantasies, the Beverly Glenn Copeland story, documentary directed by Posey Dixon, and was released in 2019. In the next clip, band member Nick Dorado describes working with Beverly Glenn Copeland.
It's funny the world that he found for himself. Even stranger now is like Glenn is in a similar situation that we're in, which is like living in an underground music world and like not really being able to make anything happen. But everybody's really intrigued by everything that's going on. So it's like, why would we not take those risks? So like strangely, we like all met up and now we're like taking on this risk, like moving into this next thing together. Like I'm always wondering when we're out with Glenn if we're making the right choice about like going for broke on the road with a 74-year-old musician. Like, you know, like, is he risking his retire? Like, it's his retirement to be with his amazing wife and family. And like, now he works. And then ever since he met us, now he works all day and night, like us. We just like, he just like met a bunch of like 20-year-old or like, you know, like mid-20s hardworking musician folks and then was like back in it instantly. He's like completely out of time and place always.
At 80 years old, Beverly Glenn Copeland is still going strong. Just released a new album in July 2023 called The Ones Ahead. I first encountered his work from a CBC broadcast from The Queue. A live performance in studio and with his band, reimagining Keyboard Fantasies from the 1986 version and updating it. And I just immediately fell in love with it. Absolutely.
Are ever new. We are the spring, the summer rain softly turn to sing again. Welcome the bud, the summer blooming flower. Welcome the child whose hand I hold. Welcome to you, both young and old. We are ever new. We are ever new.
Beverly Glenn Copeland live in the studio at CBC for the show Q. In this next clip I'm going to play from Keyboard Fantasies, the documentary by Posey Dixon, band member Nick Dorado describes first seeing Beverly Glenn Copeland perform.
It was in the middle of July. There's like no air conditioning in this old, old theater. And Jeremy and Bianca and I were like kind of all sitting next to each other in the front-ish row. And then Glenn started singing and we just all started crying and cried like the whole show.
Glenn came on and I was like, who is this human? And he started singing and I just wept and just like snot, like gross cry.
Yeah, there was like an air of mystery around him that was kind of like, once he came out and you were able to like put a body to this voice, it was like, oh wow, this human is really special.
I think everything that he was saying just like rang so true. And I just like had a full body. And I was like, wow, I'd like, for some reason, like, I need to be with this person. They have, like, a message they have to tell me.
Know that the universe will always bring you challenges. But that it is possible to feel deep gratitude, no matter the challenge. Your life is bigger than the pain that you are maybe experiencing at this time. It is infinitely huge. Your life is one with the universe itself, and there is nothing else but that. Find the people who will tell you how precious you are. Hang with them. Find a practice that will tell you how precious you are.
Keyboard Fantasies, the Beverly Glenn Copeland story documentary directed by Posey Dixon, was released in 2019. I can't find a legal copy to watch. I saw those clips on YouTube, and I'm using them live, improvising, mixing it on the radio right now. And I hope you enjoyed that. I think sometimes documentaries are... it's just nice to sort of spend time with a really lovely human. And that's what I found in that documentary, what a lovely human Beverly Glenn Copeland is. And I'll play Sunset Village from the original Keyboard Fantasies because it's just so good.
Thank you.
Sarah Pauly's Stories We Tell takes us on a journey through her family history, which takes many surprising turns as her mother Diane's secret unfolds. Throughout the film, Pauly reveals reconstructions of home footage shot on Super 8. When Pauly shows us the making of this footage at the film's end, what we've been assuming as home movies is revealed to the viewer as faked. How does this match up against claims that a documentarian must be honest with viewers? What footage is actual and what isn't? The film fools the viewer because the additional family photographs illustrate the similarities between real people and the cast of actors. As Pauly tells her story, recreation allows the viewer to experience it in the moment. The family story becomes a cinematic narrative with all the dramatic devices of a feature film. She said, "I spent 5 years deciding moment by moment and frame by frame exactly how I wanted to tell the story and what exactly I wanted to share and what truth is and how you can be shaped in a documentary." Pauly's description of the film is that it would be a search for the vagueness of truth and the unreliability of memories, which she does by allowing every single story to speak for itself, but by showing the filmmaking and contemplating how to edit the film within the film, she adds yet another layer of vagueness and unreliability, because even though we do see a wide range of stories, we're still unsure of who's telling the truth and how the telling of stories are affected by personal agendas. In a way, Pauly's choice to tell the story this way may also affirm that her truth isn't the absolute, undeniable truth. Just another version of the same story, says video essayist Victoria Singh Thompson. The reconstructions reinforce, as film scholar Michelle Renov suggests, that autobiographical works can breed a healthy skepticism regarding all documentary truth claims. You're listening to Synesthesia, which is produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajewanang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. In the background, we're listening to the work of Clint Mansell. His soundtrack for the San Junipero episode of Black Mirror.
Thank you.
reenactment's power can also come from the viewer's knowledge that the event represented truly happened. Filmmakers have used animation, they've used animation effectively to illustrate recounted events. Peter Koff writes in the Boston Globe, "With animation, you can reenact anything, and there's no pretending that it's the real thing." And he says, "Animation also adds a frisson of magic and wonder, and there have been some great documentaries that use animation to significant effects, like Marjan Satrapi's Persepolis in 2007, Ari Folman's Waltz with Bashir, 2008, and Keith Maitland's amazing Tower from 2016. As Koff writes, this would seem to contradict the notion of nonfiction film as a representation of objective reality, but in depicting the blurred region shared by perception, memory, and imagination, animation can delve into the subjective realm. In 2022, Sundance Film Festival, senior programmer Basil Tsiolkis said in Variety, "Animation demonstrates that documentary filmmaking is a form of storytelling. It underscores that it's a subjective process, and some films use it to their advantage to demonstrate that what you're seeing isn't necessarily, quote, truth, to pass doubt on how something might have gone down, or circle back and show you that one person's viewpoint is not the same as somebody else's." Off noted, The Thin Blue Line, director Errol Morris from 1988, presents a series of different reenactments of the actual murder of a policeman that evokes kind of a Rashomon-style space of conflicting narratives. I'm going to play this fun track for you from the soundtrack to Persepolis. Here's their cover of Eye of the Tiger.
The Eye of the Tiger.
was Eye of the Tiger from the music composed and directed by Olivier Bernet from the original soundtrack of the film Persepolis. You're listening to Synesthesia, which is produced live in the studio here at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nungajewinong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. And it's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. Here's a reinvented, reimagined Blood Orange remix of Beverly Glenn Copeland's Sunset Village. Thanks so much for listening. I'm L.A. Alfonso. This is Synesthesia. I'll be back next week.
Let it come, let it take on. Thoughts away.